Black Country Radio Sport.
My name's Adam Parks and you're very welcome to the latest edition of the Black Country Sportscast from Black Country Radio. And in this edition, we're putting local non-league football on the back burner for a while and discussing a sport which is very dear to my heart, and that's horse racing. Well, welcome along everybody, and an hour or so of interesting chat about horse racing to come here on the Sportscast for this particular programme. Now, for many years, Sam Turner has been at the forefront of national horse racing journalism. Having started off at the Shropshire Star, Sam eventually landed the plum job as Robin Goodfellow at the Daily Mail, position that he held for many years, taking over that role from wonderful journalists who'd held that position previously, such as the great Colin McKenzie. Sam has combined his journalistic and tipping role with punditry for the major horse racing television channels, such as Racing TV, and has combined this work with podcasts while maintaining a passion for his favourite football team, which is Wolverhampton Wanderers. I've been watching Sam on the TV for years, but only recently found out that he lives around the corner from me in Stourbridge, and quite by accident I actually found out that he lived around here because I was driving home from the radio station and saw him walking his dog, and had to take a double take to make sure that it was him because I'd seen him on the TV earlier in the day. So in the true tradition of inviting racing pundits born and bred in Wolverhampton onto the programme, and we've been very lucky to have Racing TV presenter Lydia Hislop on the show a few times in the past, I thought it would be nice to hear from Sam about his career and his thoughts about the issues affecting horse racing at the moment. Now, Sam has recently announced that he's going to be stepping down from this role as Robin Goodfellow and taking on a new role in horse racing during the course of the autumn. So I hope you enjoy this interview, which was recorded a couple of days ago. It reflects on Sam's career, about the future of the sport itself, about Sam's future. So, ladies and gentlemen, Black Country Sportscast and Black Country Radio presents Sam Turner.
So, Sam, I hadn't got a clue you lived around here until I was driving along one day and saw you walking the dog. Have you always been a Wollaston boy?
No, far from it. I was sort of Codsall, born and bred, really. Started off in Shropshire, and we sort of moved to South Staffs from an early age. And I was lucky enough to meet my wife, Kate Winning, and moved over here probably late 2000 and somethings. We got married in 2010, and then it was pretty much sort of up Causer Street for a bit, you know, around my Mary Stevens Park, lived there for a little while, and then a little bit in Stourton, and then, yeah, settled in Wollaston.
And like it, obviously.
Yeah, I do. I think it's great that everything's so close. We always had dogs as well, so, you know, within 10 minutes you can be down on the canal or over the River Stour and off into the fields, and you know, you've got some great countryside on your doorstep, which I love. Good motorway links as well for getting up and down to London for work and various race courses. So it's absolutely perfect for those purposes, really. Not too far from my mum, who's still in, you know, just on the outskirts of Wolverhampton, so half an hour there, and it was absolutely perfect.
Where's your passion for horse racing come from?
Oh, good question. I was quite a late developer, really. It was always cricket when I was a youngster. And I used to get annoyed when they'd stop showing the test match on BBC One and Richie Benno would say, right, we've got to go off to Ascot now for the next race. Although Richie Benno loved it, I didn't love it too much because I wanted to see him both and battle Graham Gooch or, whoever it might be, bowl at the time, Richard Hadley, Kapil Dev, McCann or whatever. So that was my sort of childhood years growing up watching cricket because the BBC covered it so well. They covered racing well at the time as well. But, it wasn't until probably early sixth form, something like that. I was probably about 15, 16, doing O-levels back in the day. Black and white, when things were black and white. It was that long ago. And a guy called David Wernick went to my school. And his dad was quite a famous bookmaker, Mickey Wernick, down in... he did Monmouth Green and all the local dog tracks. He was also quite a prolific poker player as well. And he was... Dave was into his betting, and he said to me one lunchtime, fancy coming down the bookies, I'm going to go down and have a bet. Now, he's a year older than me, and I said, oh, go on then. I've always quite interested in sort of gambling. it was my vice as a teenager. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink tons, but I did like fruit machines. When we were kids, you go down to the arcades of the local, when you went away for your summer holidays and stuff like that, you were always in there, playing those tipping point machines with the 2p's and stuff. So I said, yeah, go on, then I'll come down. I had 50p on a 2-1 chance it won, which is probably the worst thing that could have happened. And then I was hooked from that point. So it then sort of progressed into, I did my A-levels. I was looking for a summer job. And a friend of mine who I sort of knew through cricket was manager for Stanley Racing at the time, the bookmakers who sold out to William Hill. And I ended up being a board marker down in Whitmarines in Wolverhampton, which was quite an education for an 18-year-old, I've got to be honest, doing the morning dogs on a Saturday. We had quite an eclectic clientele base, and there was a fair amount of recreational drugs probably smoked in the shop as well. So by about the 11:32 at Crayford, I was probably away with the fairies, even more so than normal. But it was a good education. They were a good bunch down there, and you had to learn how to, you speak to people. They didn't really care much that you came from a fairly nice part of South Staffs. You had to make sure that you put the favourite up in red on the board, and you didn't miss any of the results and any of the forecasts, because that was pretty important.
I think most board markers have said that it's held them in good stead for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, well, I must admit, I felt sometime if I missed something, I got like a target on my back, because the amount of betting shop pens that come in if you missed a show from, Thirsk or wherever, it was a bit of a killer. But lots of people did it. Richard Hall's a commentator, worked in betting shops. I think there's any number of people who I work with in the racing industry that had time in a betting shop at some stage. So it was the one place that you could... Eventually, they started bringing in the pictures. They got rid of the old Excel commentary, and we actually had SIS pictures, and it was the one place that you could watch all the racing every day, and you could gain an advantage because obviously you were seeing things that a lot of people who had jobs couldn't see.
But I guess the disadvantage in the end was that there was no need for board markers when SIS came along.
Yeah, that's right. They brought all the screens in, and they also stopped smoking as well. I think I must have inhaled about 1,000 cigarettes in the 6 months that I was there. So, but it was good fun. I got round a few shops and, learned a fair bit about the industry, about racing, about betting, about losing mainly. And how you cope with that and how you evaluate races and watch races.
And you survive Whitmarines, which is a miracle in itself.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a couple of miles from probably a mile and a half from Molyneux, the shop was. At least it was in sight of the Gold Palace.
So tell me then, how did this move on to your journalism?
Well, it took a little bit of time, really. I was always fascinated by newspapers. As a kid, I always wanted to be a journalist, but I didn't really want to go away and do a degree. I wanted to earn money, basically. So I ended up getting a job with the Express and Star, but it was in advertising. So I spent, good few years there, you know, worked my way up from Lichfield office selling adverts for the free paper to, you know, working on the Express and Star full circulation in Queen Street. And that was great because it gave me good, you know, a good understanding and a good knowledge of how the newspaper industry worked. Obviously, I was, you know, every time there was a test match on, I would like slide on down past the production department and go and watch 5 minutes. You know, they got the tellies down on sports desk, and I was desperate to still work in sports journalism, essentially. So, you know, what I failed to say was during my sort of 6 week holiday or Easter holiday as a kid, I'd go and do work experience at the Express and Star. I was really fortunate. I did a couple of weeks on the ENS sports desk when the likes of Peter White, Dave Inston, Malcolm Cinnamond, you know, all those sort of people. Brian Clifford was a sports editor, you know, really good names and brilliant at what they did. I learnt a lot. Ian Bate was there, John Sexton, you know, the racing correspondent for 27 years. So that was brilliant. It whetted my appetite. So the advertising thing was a little bit of, well, I've got to earn a living, plus I've got to try and find a way without a degree to get into journalism full-time, really, and sports journalism. I didn't want to do any news journalism particularly. That didn't float my boat. It had to be sport. And eventually, after, you know, working away at with the Express and Star in advertising and then getting a job for one of my clients as, like, a PR person at their garage, I then sort of fell into writing some freelance articles for a little racing magazine, really. And, you know, it was a magazine called In the Know that was around in the 90s, and they just said, yeah, go on, we'll take your pieces and stuff. So I used to write a few tipping pieces for them, and that then in turn gave me, you know, a little bit of evidence of my work and that I wasn't a complete charlatan. Not a complete one, just half a one. And I was lucky enough to get a first proper job in journalism, which was with CFAX Racing up in Leeds.
Oh, wow, OK.
Which was brilliant because there was some great people worked up there. David Ord, who now works for the Sporting Life, main man there. John Hopkins, who works for the Racing Post, is one of their leading editors. So I was learning from really good people, not least Mike Grenham, who taught me more than I'll ever know, really. In 18 months, he told me where to put apostrophes, which I, even though I'd done quite well at English at school, still didn't know, you know, which way to put an apostrophe in a sentence. And he taught me the art of writing quickly, writing accurately, writing headlines, interviewing people. So yeah, it was a brilliant grounding. I did that for about 18 months, and then came back and worked on the Newport Advertiser.
Okay. Did when you were at Wolverhampton, did you sort of look at John Sexton's job with envy somewhat?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, that was the dream, to work in racing and get paid for it. I mean, you know, to work and cover any sport and get paid for it would have been, you know, the absolute dream, because, I mean, it doesn't feel like work then, does it? I know, you know, racing journalism's changed a lot since. Obviously, the amount of meetings has just gone through the roof. Sports journalism has changed a lot since, because obviously you're not filing for a newspaper, just a newspaper anymore. You're filing for websites, you're doing digital copy, you're doing videos, you're doing everything. You have to be multifaceted now, which I think would have been difficult at the time, because I just wasn't trained well enough to do all that sort of stuff. But you learn it along the way, and you if you've got any sense, you learn from really good people. And as I say, people like Mike Grenham, David Ord, John Hopkins taught me more than they'll ever know, really.
How did the Robin Goodfellow gig come about?
Well, that was... I'd worked for the Newport Advertiser for a bit in my probably early 30s. So late 90s, early 2000s. And the natural progression from there was to then go on to the Shropshire Star, hopefully. It was the free weekly paper in Newport, which was, you know, the sister paper, really. But unfortunately, all the free papers in the Shropshire Star group, they had a bit of a cost-cutting thing, and they wanted me to do news as well as all the sport. Well, I was quite good, because I used to design the news, the sports pages, which I enjoyed, write the copy for it, and that was almost like a full-time job. I didn't fancy doing parish council meetings at 9 o'clock at night, listening to people drone on about, you know, and I'm sorry if that sounds harsh, but that just wasn't my bag. I'd rather go and watch a bad football match, you know, finish 0-0, at least I'd find something of interest in it. And I just didn't want to do that. So I went and worked for the Sentinel up in Stoke for 6 months just as a design, you know, doing laying out the pages and stuff like that, doing the racing. And they had a Sunday supplement that they pulled out, and there was a couple of pages of racing in it, which I wrote and designed and stuff. And then a job popped up covering Telford United for Shropshire Star. Tim Nash went over to the Express and Star to cover Wolves, and there was a job covering Telford. So I did that for a couple of years. And, you know, that was brilliant, great crack. I was really lucky. I got a squad that I got on with the great majority of them. Got on really well with the manager, Jake King, who was brilliant to me. His assistants were superb. All the players were great. You know, I just tried to write what I saw and try and look after the team a little bit, because the budget wasn't great that they were on. You know, we had players that were playing for 100 quid a week, you know, and they were going up against the likes of Rushden and Diamonds and Dagenham. We were paying Mark Steen, you know, four figures a week. So it was
quite a successful time for them, though, wasn't it, at the Buckshead, or the old Buckshead?
Yeah, that's right. Andy Shaw had gone in. They'd gone full-time, I think. And, as you know, Andy tried really... I mean, he'd redeveloped the ground as well, because obviously he was a developer. And he redeveloped the ground, did a good job. I mean, I know it all went pear-shaped at one point, but the time that I was there, I think they were finishing sort of 7th, 8th in the league, you know, and they were holding their own against the best sides, and I really enjoyed it for a couple of years. Anyway, I still did the racing for the Shropshire Star, and I was lucky enough to win the NAPS competition 1 year, where everything fell in my lap, and it just, you know, you just have one of them runs where everything happens for you. And it was sort of 2001-2, something around that time. So I'd got something to hang my hat on a little bit with racing. And you know, I'd do all the reports from Ludlow or wherever it might be, Bangor for the Shropshire Star, and really enjoyed that. But the Wednesday nights at Boston, when you get no but three and you've still got to write 900 words and all that sort of stuff, they weren't quite holding the same lustre as, you know, when we're a 3-0 defeat to Steve Evans, you know, expensively assembled squad, and I knew what Telford were paying their players. It just felt all a bit uneven, really. So on the weekends where Telford had a game in the capital, like Stevenage or Dagenham or whoever it might be, Kingstonian, I wrote to the Mail and just said, look, would there be any chance of any casual work, you know? So they'd say, yeah, come in as a freelance. So I'd go in there on a Sunday, I'd stay with a friend on Saturday night, and then I'd go into the offices on the Sunday and just do a subbing shift, basically. I think I got 150 quid, slept on my friend's floor, and, you know, but it was brilliant because I was getting to know how it all worked. It was obviously... You just couldn't allow a mistake to go in the paper. So there was loads of sets of eyes would go across the racing. We'd check it, you know, with military precision. I'd rewrite copy, I'd do headlines, I'd do all that sort of stuff, and I'd do the tips if somebody was off. So it was great experience for me, really. And I was very, very lucky to be, you know, in a position where A, I could earn a bit of extra money, and B, I could they got to know me as well as I got to know them. So Marcus Townend was my racing editor at the time, and he was my racing editor when I finished at the Mail, you know, 20 years later. And we've always had a brilliant relationship, and I think it stemmed from there that he could see I got a work ethic, and I was happy to, you know, learn from him, really, and listen. You know, and I wasn't too trappy. That came a bit later on, probably.
I know technology has changed your job completely, as you mentioned. I also guess, as you've alluded to, with the amount of meetings, the amount of racing that goes on now, that it's probably somewhat stamina sapping as a job now, and that you do need regular breaks, otherwise you just cave in, I guess.
Yeah, that's very true. That is extremely true. And, you know, there have been times where I've gone through the summer without necessarily having a week's holiday, or, you know, even 10 days, God forbid, because you feel like you can't take that time off. You know, I just counted this week, there's 37 flat meetings. If you're trying to do a job professionally, you need to see most of those, if not all of them, and every race at it. Now, you're saying there's probably, you know, an average of seven races per meeting. You know, it's the best part of 250 races that you've got to wade through. Now, if you miss those in any given week, that's a huge amount of the form book that, you know, is just passed you by. And people say, well, can't you catch up? And you just can't catch up, because the volume of racing now means that there aren't the hours in the day to be able to catch up. It, you know, it starts at 1:30, 2:00. It finishes at 9:30, 9:00 in the middle of the summer. And, you know, by the time you roll round, if you're doing that shift, watching racing all day, well, people say, well, you're not digging the road, and you're not. It's not hard work physically, but mentally it can be quite taxing day after day after day after day, especially if you're getting paid to produce winning tips. And in our game, you know, if you have a strike rate of 25% with your tips for, you know, 25 winners for every 100 tips you make, that's a pretty good strike rate. You know, jockeys are, if they get to 15%, that's an extremely good strike rate. Mm. So as a tipster, 75% of the time, 3/4 of the time you're losing. Mm. You know, mentally that can be quite a draining situation to be in, and sometimes that can be up to 80% depending on the run you're going on. You've got to be prepared that no matter how good you are going to be largely unsuccessful. Mm. You will have your moments of success. And you think if you put the work in and you do the study, but then sort of variance takes over and you might have a run of unbelievable bad luck. And you've then got to cope with that mentally, and that can be quite soul-destroying.
We used to have a philosophy at work on a Friday afternoon where we'd pick out a four-horse Yankee for a Saturday afternoon out of the Express and Star. And everyone said, I'll just avoid whatever John Sexton's put down because he's just picked out the favourite. I mean, was it tempting to always go for the bookie's favourite rather than perhaps, you know, put a bit of brain cells behind it?
Well, that I did it before I sort of joined... Because I left the Shropshire Star, and before I actually got the job with the Mail full time as Robin Goodfellow, I worked on the Sportsman for a little while. I was going to be freelance when I left the Shropshire Star. I got enough work to actually be freelance. I ran a small little tipping service. I did some writing. I did a bit of TV. I'd got enough in a pot that I thought, do you know what, I can work 3-4 days a week. I can catch up the other 2 days, and I can have a pretty good life of this. Anyway, I got a job with the Sportsman, which is an ill-fated paper down in London. It only lasted 9 months and lost 15 million quid. And it was a competitor, really, to the Racing Post. And after a month or two, they started it off with a racing supplement inside the football. Was the main paper, and the racing sort of pull out came in the inside. Anyway, they worked out that it would be better if they put the racing on the outside, the football on the inside, and perhaps stop paying people like Alan Brazil fortunes to write a column in it. So we then decided, oh well, not we, that the powers that be decided they needed a person or a tipping feature to go up against Pricewise, because Pricewise was massive back in the day, wasn't it? You know, talking 18, 19 years ago when it was in its pomp, before a lot of other things came in to render those Pricewise grids as pretty pointless in the paper now. And they came up with Oddscracker, and they hadn't got anybody to do it. Everyone thought it was a poison chalice and ducked it. Anyway, my name was last on the list. So I was a sacrificial lamb that got thrown forward to do this Oddscracker, or Old Knacker, as some of my friends renamed the feature. So that then gave me a vehicle. I was very lucky. I'd sort of inherited a vehicle to be able to go up against Pricewise, and I had a couple of winners. The speed ratings that I was calculating at the time, and still do, they had a bit of an edge, and I felt that you know, I could hold my own because I had that little bit of an edge on other people and on the markets as well. That's since been eroded a little bit because speed figures have become more commercially available, and a lot of people do them themselves as well, and do sectional times, and they've really woken up to the positives that they can offer you as a punter.
How much has television helped your career? Because I think the first time I saw you was on the old Racing UK, and I think you were at Ludlow, probably with Stuart Machin, and it was you were introduced as Sam Turner from the Shropshire Star at the time. Do you think that helped kickstart your career doing that bit of TV work?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of people thought Stuart and I were married for a good period of time. To be honest, we were inseparable. We would have needed a surgeon to separate us, whether it was either Stratford, Warwick, or Ludlow. I mean, he's such a vastly underrated broadcaster, brilliant, brilliant broadcaster, great commentator as well, and a great man. And he's he never once thrown me under the bus, and never once sort of put me in a position where I found it awkward and bailed me out more than, you know, a number of occasions. So he's been brilliant to work with. And working with people like him really, really helped me. I hadn't got a lot of confidence to do stuff like that at the start. I know that sounds a bit daft, but standing up and doing talks or, you know, giving interviews or doing TV and stuff like that just didn't come naturally at all to me. When I was at the Express and Star, having to do sort of advertising campaigns and, you know, with a whiteboard and writing all set, people would say that they could see the blood, you know, visibly drain from me. It was the kind of thing that kept me awake at night and it gave me nightmares. But the TV really helped because effectively you were talking to one person and they were right, there's a camera on you, but it didn't feel as though you were speaking to 20,000 people. It gave me a bit more confidence to be able to talk about the subject, and providing you researched it well and you'd done your homework, you always feel then confident about what you're talking about.
I suppose as a subscription channel as well, the pressure is perhaps a bit more on you to sort of know what you know about that day's racing.
Yeah, very much so, because you know that there'll be people sitting at home that will probably know a good deal more than you do. And they will tell very quickly whether you're winging it or not. And you're throwing out the old familiar racing cliches and this and that. And, you know, you've got to come up with a different edge. You're there, as you say, on a subscription channel where, you know, you watch the guys on Sky Sports Cricket or Sky Sports Football, or, you know, they're brilliant at what they do because they educate you. Even if you think you know a fair bit about football and cricket, they are still taking you to another level with their knowledge. And really, that's what you have to aim to do racing-wise, really. You have to try and spot something that, OK, 5% of the audience might spot, but 95% might not see it that way, you know, whether it be a track bias or whether it be a horse that can't jump ditches particularly well, or audience might spot, but 95% might not see it that way, you know, whether it be a track bias or whether it be a horse that can't jump ditches particularly well, or a horse that goes better right-handed than left. All those sort of pointers that you might just be helping someone with their betting in a month's time when the horse runs again, you know. So that's the idea anyway.
As part of this job, I guess when you've done your TV work, it's sort of developed over the years from Ludlow and Warwick, and I've seen you in your morning suit at Epsom, I think, this year, and many occasions I've seen you at Newmarket. Which do you prefer, flat or jumps?
Yeah, I actually wore that morning suit on the wrong day as well. I wore it on the Friday and the Saturday. You're only supposed to wear it on the Saturday.
I didn't know to say that.
That's very kind of you. Thanks very much, Adam, for not mentioning that. I wasn't the only one. Thankfully, there was two of us, both from Racing TV, funny enough. And we'll both claim that we got some misinformation from those above us. But, what do I prefer? I think my heart, I'll always... Because I was a Cheltenham member as a kid, so that will always be a special place to me. And jump racing was what... I think I fell in love with racing. I fell in love with jump racing predominantly. You know, and obviously I spent a lot of time at Ludlow. I've got a lot of love and affinity for that track. And I like all the Midlands tracks, you know, Warwick, Stratford, getting round all of them. But I think flat racing I've found easier to pick big price winners on. Although that said... I think if you sort of... I've always loved handicap hurdles, like good quality handicap hurdles. I think I've got a fairly good record in those. But I think flat racing, because I do the speed ratings for the flat, I think perhaps that, yeah, the flat is slightly easier to win on and to pick winners on and just to see future winners, if that makes any sense. I think jumping's become difficult because of the change of the ground a lot. I mean, you know, we didn't have any rain last year and a lot of the form... gets turned on its head sometimes when you get to a festival. Sometimes we'll have a very wet winter and a very dry summer, so all that wet winter form is worthless. You might as well throw it out. And sometimes it's the other way around. So I think my heart will always... If I could only watch one type of racing, I think it would be, you know, Cheltenham, Aintree, Sandown, you know, those. But I also love going summer racing on the July course at Newmarket or York.
I think we both agree on that. Jumps with the heart and flat with the head. And I think the problem with the jumps is that the better horses, you rarely see run during the winter time, and they only come out for Cheltenham after perhaps two or three runs. whereas the flat horses you can follow through during the course of the summer from May to November, really, because the trainers will try and get as many runs into them as possible, and you'll follow their progress as the year progresses.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on. I think the one positive with the jumpers, if they stay fit, they're around for a few more years and you build a love for them. I mean, you know, you look back at the likes of Corto Star and how he did year in, year out, you know, Five King Georges and Betfair Chases and Gold Cups. And, I mean, you know, he was once in a lifetime horse. I think we took him for granted a little bit. And some people say, well, we knew it at the time. And yes, we did, because he was racking up all those wins. But you look back now at how horses are campaigned compared to that and what Paul Nicholls did with him and bringing back Denman. You know, there was a bit of a golden era, really, certainly for the yard, with Masterminded around as well, and, you know, all sorts of other horses.
But I was going to say, on the flat side, certainly with the jumps, people will build up an affinity with a horse, because, like you say, it turns up year after year after year, the likes of Desert Orchid, Kato Star, etc. With the flat horses, they tend to run as 2 and 3 year olds, and then if they're any good, they'll go off to stud. Do you think that's frustrating from perhaps a racing perspective as a whole, as to how it's sold to the general public?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to sell it, isn't it? I mean, obviously they did a very good job selling Frankel and See the Stars, but they're very much the anomalies, aren't they? We don't see those. They're once in a decade horses, almost those. I think there's a little bit more of a trend, certainly with people like Shadwell or operations like Shadwell, to keep horses in training a little bit longer. Godolphin have tried it a little bit this year. It hasn't worked out brilliantly, but Shadwell, you know, the likes of Hookham at 6 is winning Group 1s. They've done extremely well with horses that have stayed around for a few years. And, you know, they could have easily sent Hookham to stud. He had almost like a career-ending injury after winning the Coronation Cup, and they gave him the time off, and he's come back, you know, almost better than ever. So, you know, that's it's great to see that aggressive campaigning and not, you know, trying to preserve a stud career. But then you see the money that's on offer. If you've got a good stallion, it's understandable why they do it. You know, then a lot of these operations aren't in it just for the love of racing. They love racing, but they have to make it commercially viable.
And we'll touch on that a little bit later. Just going back to picking the winners and your tips every day, is there a horse that you've tipped that's put a few quid into your pocket?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a difficult one, that. I can't really think of sort of one off the top of my head.
There was not had a big 50-1 winner or anything like that.
Well, there was. I mean, I've had a few that were sort of 20-1, 25-1, something like that. Mahayed was a good horse for me. A horse of Dan Skelton's, who won a handicap hurdle. You know, he was grand. There was an old horse of Hughie Morrison's, Marble Arch, that I did quite well from back in the day. I think I was actually, that might have been the year, pretty much the year that won the Naps competition when he was around, because I remember him winning the what used to be the old Ladbroke handicap at Ascot, the one they run just before Christmas. I'm sure he won that with Norman Williamson on. Was it the Tote Gold Trophy? I can't remember one of the two anyway. But I know I was at Dagenham covering Telford United, and I missed the first 10 minutes of the game because I was trying to watch the race in the betting shop close by.
I shouldn't worry about that. We've tried to do football commentaries of Stourbridge on Boxing Day while trying to watch the King George at the same time. Yeah. So it's not easy to be in three places at once. I'm going to ask you, I'm not going to ask you about the worst people in this case, I'm going to ask you about the best people, because we don't want to get sued or anything. No, but can you give me an idea, from a journalistic perspective, who are the easiest to work with? So I'm going to start off with the easiest National Hunt trainer.
I think there's a few, to be fair. I think they're a really good bunch in the main. I would say all of the British ones. The Irish guys can be a little bit evasive, or they just don't give you a lot. You know, the Gordon Elliotts and Willie Mullins of this world, they're not very effusive about horses. Willie probably a bit more than Gordon, but, I don't think that's a deliberate thing. It's just how they are. But then you might speak to Nicky Henderson, and he treats his horses like they're his children. You know, poor Nicholls never struggled for a quote from Paul. He's always brilliant. And then those in behind, Dan Skelton speaks very eloquently about a number of subjects regarding the game. Fergal O'Brien, all these sort of people. Then you've got younger mob coming through, the Harry Derhams of this world, who were brilliant to deal with and very open. I think we're very lucky, sort of National Hunt-wise. I mean, you and I, we've probably both been to the races. We've seen McCoy take a fall on one, or Richard Johnson take a fall on one, you know, limping back with his saddle under his arm. And some kid's gone up to them and asked them for an autograph. And they've gone, yep, yeah, no problem. They've put the saddle down, signed it, done a picture. I mean, these are incredible people, you know. I asked Jeff Boycott for an autograph once at Cheltenham when I was watching Yorkshire versus Gloucestershire, and I won't repeat what he said to me, but it wasn't, come back later, son. I'll be welcomed. I'll be happy to do it. I mean, they are a breed on their own, really, and they are very, very accessible. I went to the darts the other year up at Blackpool, you know, the match player, and Sam Twister Davis was in the bar and having a crack with everybody. They're just really normal people. They're a bit unhinged. You've got to be to go 35 mile an hour over fences. And, you know, there's an ambulance following you around. So that's the only job in the world where that happens.
So we'll put National Hunt jockeys and trainers in the same bracket. They're all pretty accessible.
Yeah, I can't think of any. I mean, I once rung Josh Gifford once on a Sunday morning. I think he'd had a fairly decent Saturday night. And he shouted down the phone at me a little bit when I was at CFAX Racing. But that's because I asked a bloody stupid question, to be honest, so I deserved it. Yeah, but most of them. The Duke, David Nicholson, I remember ringing him on a Sunday morning as well. And I would say that he was... I won't say he was rude. He wasn't rude. Brusque is the word I was searching for, but very helpful. But then, you know, on the flat side of it, I think, to be fair to them, they have bigger strings. I think it's difficult for some flat guys to be able to say what they want to say because they have very prominent owners, you know, often from royal families across the world, and they have to be very, very careful what they say because even one line can be picked up.
Does that not come across as elitist, though?
Well, that's just flat racing, isn't it? It is a bit, you know, you're training for, you know, if you're fortunate, you could be training for the King and Queen of this country, you could be training for His Royal Highness Sheikh Mohammed in Dubai, you could be training for royal family from Bahrain, from Qatar. That's just flat racing, isn't it? National Hunt racing is much more for the common man. That's probably why we like it so much. It's not quite a sport of the people, is it? Because you have still got people, you know, manage huge hedge funds in London paying £500,000 for a horse, and there's no way on earth that, you know, unless that turns out to be a Gold Cup winner, that is ever going to yield any profit for them. But, you know, that's a shame that, you know, we have at the moment very dominant Irish stable, which is totally dominating National Hunt racing. And it's all right, these things are cyclical and they do go in circles, and it won't be long before perhaps another British flats National Hunt trainer like Paul Nicholls finds a raft of horses like he did, you know, around 2010, 11, 12, whatever, and can challenge William Mullins again full-time, go toe-for-toe, but it's a while away, I think.
Yeah, needs the owners to send the right horses as well to train us like that. And at the moment, I'm not sure what Ireland are doing right. I suspect, to a certain extent, it's less racing over there, and the racing is of a better quality when they do race, but perhaps we'll talk about that a little bit later. We're talking about the difference between National Hunt and flat, and I said perhaps elitist is how you could look at the flat a little bit. But then again, the jockeys never come across as elitist, and we've got someone like Frankie Dettori who's been in the game for such a long time, and he's retiring this year. And for me, he's probably brought more to horse race than many, many more people have involved in the sport over the years.
Oh, without shadow of a doubt. I mean, you know, if you ask most people in the street to name, you know, two people in horse racing, they'll still name John McCrick, bless him, you know, and he's been dead a number of years.
Or Lester Piggott.
Yeah, maybe Lester of a certain vintage, but, you know, you ask anybody under 30, they probably wouldn't know Lester Piggott. And Dettori, you know, maybe one or two people might say A.P. McCoy. You know, you might get the odd Paul Nicholls or a Nicky Henderson for those people who've been racing a little bit more, but it's all been Dettori and McCrick, and those are the two names. And we are going to miss him. You know, we're going to miss him dreadfully. He's riding as well as ever into his 50s. I mean, he's just an astonishing athlete, really. I don't think that really quite gets quite gets covered enough, really. Gets enough exposure, what an athlete he is, to still be competing with kids half his age, and in some cases a third of his age, you know, that find getting fit very easily. And, you know, this is a guy, all right, he picks and chooses where he rides now. He's earned that right to do that. But for a number of years, he's schlepped up and down the country and, you know, across the world and all this sort of stuff. Okay, you're going first class, etc. But it still takes its toll on your body and your mind. He had a lot of pressure as well. He's worked with pressure, you know, for 25, 30 years at least. And what he's achieved has just been nothing short of extraordinary, really. You know, still winning Guineas this year. Obviously, you know, we record this and he's won another Group 1 in France this afternoon. The fourth time in succession that he's won the Prix Jacques Le Marois. Second year running on Inspiral. And that was a masterclass of a ride in itself. He was poorly drawn. He got into a best part of the track and he delivered the filly to win well. I mean, he's just extraordinary. There's two sides to Frankie. There's the side that you see in front of the cameras, and there's a side when there's no camera, you know, rolling and not on him, then there's a different side to him, you know, and that's fair enough. He has a different personality. He certainly has a very strong charisma or a very charismatic personality in front of the cameras, and then sometimes he can be a bit bolshy off them. But, you know, that's fair enough. I mean, this is... I always think we don't really give these flat jockeys enough slack. I mean, if you were deprived of food for, you know, 90% of your life and you could have a piece of chicken in the evening every other day and you had to have a hot bath. I mean, McCoy was incredible, you know. Like, he'd be riding at 10 stone 1, 10 stone 2, and his natural weight is probably 12 stone. That's a massive difference.
It was quite astonishing. There was a documentary done about following Tony McCoy and his day-to-day routine. And you sort of look at him and you think, I couldn't do that. I couldn't go in these cold baths, ice baths or whatever. You know, it looked like a really, really difficult regime. And, of course, if you're doing that day in, day out, and in case of Frankie Dettori, because flat racing around the world is a 12-month-a-year sport, it's just so difficult to do. He could have retired a long time ago because he's made enough money.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, they live for it, don't they? I mean, I always think with McCoy as well, I don't think he rode for the money. I mean, yes, it was a nice byproduct, and he became a very wealthy man, and rightly so, for putting your body under those pressures and strains and stresses for as many years as he did. But if you said to McCoy now, you know, if you pay £1 million, you get 5 years of your career back, when you were feeling fit and healthy in your 30s, he'd sign the cheque now. You know, he misses the buzz of race riding, and he loved winning, you know. And he will tell you that 85% of his career, people say, look at all these winners you rode. He says, yeah, I almost lost more. I also lost more races than anybody else. And that's him. You know, he's got unbelievable humility and modesty. But he will tell you that you know, there were times where he went through Cheltenham and didn't have a winner, and he was foul to live with. You know, he was so much of a winner, and winning drove him so strongly that I think you could have ripped the cheque up. If he said, right, you're going to win the Gold Cup every other year, but you're not going to get paid for it, he'd go, yeah, fine, that's no problem.
In another era, would Richard Johnson have been champion jockey?
Well, yeah, he was a runner-up 20 times, wasn't he? Thankfully, he did win it when McCoy retired, which was just desserts, really, for Dickie. I think at the end, you know, it probably was the end for him, but I think there were spells during that two-decade period where he was virtually on a par with McCoy. But of course, McCoy had good link-ups. You know, you rode for Martin Pipe, and that almost guaranteed you the title at that point.
How easy a clerk of the course is to work with from a journalistic perspective?
Some are better than others. It's one of the bugbears of mine that we don't get accurate going reports by a certain time every day. I don't think it's a difficult thing to achieve in this day and age. I really don't. Some are brilliant at it. Some feel as though, as press, we're looking to catch them out, whereas I don't think we are. I just think we want, you know, I don't think anybody sets out to mislead, although I haven't said that. I think people certainly have in the past set out to produce false, you know, they've over-egged the, you know, if the ground's quick, they've said it's good with good to firm places where it's just been fast. Although I know that for a fact because I've spoke to jockeys and trainers after, you know, during race meetings. But I think the great majority of Clerk of the Courses are good. I think the information with any aspect of sport, I think, and you know, whether that's watching football matches live with VAR, you know, the paying customers should have first recourse to the information, shouldn't they? And those, I don't think it's that difficult to say, right, by 7 o'clock every day, we are going to give you the going for that particular meeting. And sometimes it can be 7:45 or 7:30 or 7:55 or, and you're waiting around and, you know, people want to have a bet. You know, this sport revolves around people having a bet and turnover, hopefully, increasing because therefore the levy then gets a better share. Prize money does better and everybody profits from it. So if people are holding on and not being able to have a bet and then something else crops up in the morning or they think, oh, right, I can't have a bet. I don't know whether it's good to firm or good to soft. They could have had 20 mil. They might have had 4 mil. Blah, blah. I'm not going to put this bet on. They go to work or they walk the dog. They go to work. They go and do something else and they don't have a bet. You know, and I just think we should be able to produce going reports, you know, by 6:30, 7 o'clock. Most Clerk of the Courses are up then. They'll have seen the rain gauges, you know, and I think a lot of them do it. I think a lot of them do get the, you know, they do understand what their responsibilities are, but I think there's one or two that could improve.
York a good one?
York are brilliant. I think York are right up there, sort of, you know, top three, if not number one. I think he's done a brilliant, brilliant job there. The fella that's in charge, and he's just, I just think he's amazing. He always fronts up.
It was William Darby, I'm not sure if it's still...
Yeah, it's still William, yeah. Does a brilliant job there, both commercially. I think you go up there. I remember going up there pre-COVID. It was like 25 quid for a bottle of champagne on a race course, which is unheard of. Because it's three figures in some courses down south. I think he's been brilliant with his information, the way that they've marketed the race course, the development at the race course. You never see York empty, really. They put on good racing. I think they're the benchmark and the barometer for a lot of courses, to be honest.
For many years, Cheltenham was my favourite race course, but having got myself a go racing in Yorkshire season ticket last year, I went around the various 10 race courses and I had the opportunity to go to York for the first time. And I fell in love with the place. It is like the Ascot of the North, and you could understand why when Royal Ascot couldn't take place in 2005, that they moved it up to York.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was brilliant. And obviously, if Ascot hadn't got a grandstand that cost a fortune, it might be nice to take it back up there occasionally, but that's never going to happen, unfortunately. But, yeah, they did a brilliant job of hosting it. And they are brilliant. And we've got their big meeting coming up in August, the Ebor meeting, and they've got, you know, the richest handicap in Europe. And they just get it, I think, you know. And I mean, you speak as you find, don't you? And I remember doing a, I'm not sure, I think it was for the Friends of Alfie Johnson. We did a raffle or a you know, an auction, and I wrote to William. I said, is there anything, you know, you could do? Just because I knew the type of people that they were, and you know, you wouldn't get a no. And he said, yeah, no problem. He said, put us down for a, you know, two badges and a table in the restaurant, like that. Came back within 15 minutes, you know, and you just think, you know, you don't have to do that. How many requests must he get? This is a, you know, a charity doing brilliant work locally, but he wouldn't know him from Adam, you know. It means a lot to our hearts, and what they do is magnificent. And Paul Johnson and his team with the Friends of Alfie Johnson. But, you know, William came back and said, yeah, no problem. And it's not as if it's some two-bit course somewhere. And not that every course in the country is two-bit, obviously. That's harsh to say. But, like, this is York, you know, it's a Group 1 track. And he's saying, yeah, do that for, yeah, nice feature day on a Saturday, no problem at all.
And a horse which seems to have become everybody's friend during the course of the season is a horse called Paddington, which is, in a way, nice because it's been nearly 12 months since we lost the Queen, and, of course, everyone associated Paddington with a Jubilee just before she passed on. But he's got, an interesting race at the Judmond International on the first day of the York meeting, and he still looks as good as ever.
he's an incredible horse, because when he was winning at the Curra in the spring and you know, handicaps, believe it or not, and listed races and stuff, he wasn't doing speed figures or times that were anything exceptional, really. And it wasn't till he went to Ascot and won the mile race, the St James's Palace, the name escapes me, it's my age, and he won that in great style, beat Chaldean and all the three-year-olds like Isaac Shelby in real style, that he clocked a really good figure. And then obviously he went to the Eclipse, stepped up on that again, and then won the Sussex on horrible ground at Goodwood, beating the French horse. And he's just improved. I mean, he's the only horse, I think, that he runs, and then 2 days later he's heavier than when he was actually, you know, way before his race. I mean, he's just an incredible physical specimen. He's come along at just the right time as well for Ballydoyle and Coolmore, because they've developed a, you know, a very special horse. And if he goes and wins a Judmont over a mile and a quarter, you know, he's stamping himself as something exceptional. What's he won already? Six. You know, if he could go through the year unbeaten, and they will campaign him aggressively. They did the same with Giant's Causeway. I think he got beat early on in the year in a couple of guineas, and then he came out and, you know, won the Eclipse in style and ended up in America, you know, in the Breeders' Cup.
And I think people take to them more when they are race aggressively. Mm. See, the Stars is one that came to mind, yeah, in that respect. And I think, you know, you want a horse that you can sort of follow right through the season and will have plenty of appearances. I think Frankel only ran about six times as a three-year-old, didn't he, in total, and finished at the Champions Day at Ascot. And he was a wonderful horse, but I always felt we didn't quite see enough of him.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, there is that, but he was such a prize asset, wasn't he? I mean, to be fair, and look what he's doing as a sire. So he's still giving back, isn't he, to the game? He's all right. We might not have seen him for as long as we liked, but you know, look at the progeny he's producing. Got a ridiculous strike rate when it comes to Group One winners against runners. So he's he is still at least providing some superstars going forward. But Paddington, it'd be interesting to see where he goes. If he, after Judmont, say he wins that and beats Moschadaf and some other really good horses, that could be the race of the year. That, I mean, that looks an absolutely phenomenal race in prospect. But whether they roll the dice and think about the Arc de Triomphe for the first weekend in October over a mile and a half as well, and then you've got a horse that's carried all before him over a mile, mile and a quarter, mile and a half, that makes him some prospect to stud.
The problem is, or the nice problem to have, is as long as he keeps winning, the options are still there. Franco was in the same situation after winning the Judmont. They were saying, where do you go? Do you go to the Arc? Do you go to Champions Day at Ascot? And eventually, I suppose, there's always Breeders' Cup to think about as well.
Yeah, because, you know, obviously Ballydoyle do love going out there. They feel it makes them commercially even more viable as a stallion if they can win out there. And that would suit him, you would think. Probably better than an Arc on deep ground in the first week of October. If it was as soft as it was when Alpinista won last year, you wouldn't have thought that would play to his strengths over the mile and a half quite as much. And, you know, do they really need to go to 12 furlongs? They've got a real quality horse over 8 and 10. You know, the Judmont, that's you know, that's a race that makes champions, really. So it'd be fascinating to see whether he goes there, and then he could probably go to Champions Day if they wanted to. There's all sorts of options, and then perhaps roll on to the Breeders' Cup.
I'm going to ask you in a minute to ask if going racing is value for money for the humble punter, because I know you got your thoughts about that. But a couple of quick fire ones for you. A journalist, either in TV or in newspaper, that has inspired you or that you look up to even now?
Plenty of journalists, really, that I really respect. I'm lucky enough to call them friends. You know, the likes of Marcus Townend, who's taught me an awful lot at the Mail. I'm not just saying that, but I think he's a brilliant operator, sees a story well, you know, digs out the odd exclusive, and just writes really well. I think he's underrated, believe it or not, for someone who's been in the game for, you know, 30, 40 years. Dave Yates, The Mirror, I've got a lot of time for. Marcus Armitage, when he can get some space in his paper. Unfortunately, you know, they're having a bit of a problem, The Telegraph, with the same as the Daily Mail, really. He's fighting for space all the time, which is a bit of an issue, because I say we, it's hard to get out of that habit of saying we on the Daily Mail, but the Daily Mail, they print all the race cards, and of course that eats into the possible space that you can have. So unless you've got a sports editor that is a big racing fan, he's not then going to find you another 300 or 400 words to carry a good racing story.
Hasn't that always been the case, though?
Yes and no. I think there have been times definitely where we've got a good tale, either, you know, Marcus or myself has got a good story, and it should have got more prominence than it did, but it didn't get the prominence because we were carrying 6 race cards, you know, with the best will in the world, on a Wednesday afternoon, 5 race cards or something, and the racing was pretty average, you know. And that was always a bit of an issue for me. People say, oh yeah, we need all this racing. We, you know, people want to go racing. I said, well, that's fine. But then don't complain when the racing coverage isn't very good, because we just haven't got the space. We've almost taken up nearly 2 pages with the race cards. We've got a little slot at the top for some editorial. We can't even include a picture. It basically looks like 2 pages of data, which for a sports editor who's not bonkers on racing, it just means that it's not very aesthetically good to look at, you know, and that's what newspapers have to be now. They have to be aesthetically nice to look at, with nice features, pictures, all that sort of stuff. You can't get that into racing because there's so much racing.
Past or present, do you have a favourite racing television presenter? And also, past or present, do you have a favourite commentator, course commentator?
Oh, yeah,
and you can't have Stuart Machin for both of them, because yeah, you've already had him.
Yeah, each way double Stuart Machin. Stuart would definitely be up there, because I think he's vastly underrated as a presenter. I think he's smooth. I think his interviews sort of walking in with the jockeys at the Cheltenham Festival as well, he just never drops one. You know, he's just always on the money with them. I've been really, really fortunate to, you know, a lot of very good broadcasters have indulged me in my 20 years doing TV. I'd say Nick Luck would be, you know, top of the tree. I had the fortune to work with him last week at Goodwood. Just brilliant. I mean, you know, I did a couple of morning lines with Nick as well when Channel 4 had the racing, including one up at Ayr for the Scottish National. I called it a night at 11 o'clock on the Friday night. He was still going, apparently, at 3 in the morning in some nightclub in Troon. And he will well deny this if he ever hears it. And we were supposed to be sort of, you know, in situ at 7:30 to have a run through, and he bowled in, I'd say, at, you know, 20 to 8, you know, having had about 3 hours sleep. And honestly, that hour was some of the best presenting I've ever had the privilege to see. Lydia Hislop, superb at what she does. A lot of respect for Lids.
From your neck of the woods, of course.
Yeah, yeah, but Wolves fan. And yeah, she I think she went to, I don't know whether it was school, I won't misquote what school she went to, but yeah, she's a Wolverhampton girl. Rishi Prasad, who, you know, I've spent a lot of time with doing podcasts and racing TV recently at Goodwood. Yeah, great lad. There's a number of them. There's some young guns coming through on racing TV as well, which I think, you know, going to be excellent going forward. Yeah, there's lots of them. I can't honestly say David Fitzgerald, another one that I really enjoy working with. You know, I can't honestly say that there isn't anybody that I don't get on with. I know people say, oh yeah, I'm sure there's people you gel with better than others. And there are. And there's some people that you'll do a 8 race card with and it'll feel like 10 minutes. Some people you do a 6 race card with at Ludlow and it'll feel like, you know, a week. But they're very much in short supply, those. You know, I can't honestly say I don't get on with anybody I've worked with.
I've had a conversation with Jonathan Neeson once,
yeah.
who is a bit like the Jeff Boycott that you alluded to when you go and ask for an interview. He's very straight and down the middle, and he will say what he thinks, whether you like it or not. But I think sometimes that's what you want, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think there's room for all sorts, isn't there? You know, some people go, oh, I can't stand Neeson, he does this, he does that. And other people, oh, I love Neeson, he tells it exactly how it is. I've always got on fine with Jonathan. I worked with him at Cheltenham, with him and Lydia, who I know are very close. The one thing to say about Jonathan, Christ, he knows his horses. You know, he does know those National Hunt horses like the back of his hand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think he's, well, he stood the test of time, hasn't he? He's still, he must be into his 70s now and still doing it. He must be one of the oldest broadcasters, I would imagine, on any channel.
Yeah, first time I saw him, he was the pundit for Point to Point Racing when they showed that back in the day. So is going racing a waste of money, or do you think punters are short chains, or what would you like to see different?
I don't think it's a waste of money. I think you get a great experience. If you know, if you're going to a good meeting and you want to get the best out of it, if you want to go in a bar and drink, it's probably a bit of a waste of time, isn't it? But if you want to get around the paddock, you want to take some pictures, you want to get some videos, you want to watch them down at the start, if you're going jump racing, you want to go down by the last fence at Cheltenham and watch them jump at speed, you go out on the cross-country course at Cheltenham, cross the course and go and watch them there from the viewing area. I think you can get so close to the action. And you can get close to the horses as well around the paddock, and there's not many sports where you can do that. You know, you've normally got a boundary edge, or you're stuck in a stand and you can't get that close to them, but with horse racing you can. And I think you can get quite close to the practitioners as well. You know, you can get close to the jockeys, trainers, all these sort of people. You know, you can get autographs, you can get selfies, you can get pictures. So I think if you're a young fan and you want to get into a sport, I think racing's great. You know, it's a lot of pomp and ceremony and colour, and you know, there's some explosive language, and there's always a bit of action if you go to the jumpers, and I think it's a great day. I think
do some courses charge too much though?
Yeah, I think they do. I think, you know, the price, but the trouble is they still sell out. You know, Cheltenham charge too much. You know, it's well over £100 now. They'll say, well, yeah, but it's £140 to go to the first day at Lords in the grandstand, or it's this amount of money to go to the Grand Prix, or is it? So it's an elite sporting event, isn't it? So they're always going to charge a fair amount. But does that make it right? It's just, yeah, we're charging on a par. But why do you have to charge on a par? Why can't you, you know? But they'll say, well, we keep the prices high because we want to... Perhaps, I don't know whether they go on the record say this, but that we want to have a certain clientele, perhaps, you know, and we want to ensure that, you know, we don't want to be oversubscribed. And they have, in fairness to Cheltenham, they have recognised a lot of complaints that it was too busy, and they have reduced the capacity on some of the days, which has made life a little bit easier. I won't go Gold Cup Day anymore. I just find it just ridiculous, which is a shame because I used to love Gold Cup Day. But you're queuing to get into toilets, you know, you can't get a drink. If you get a drink, it's £7 or £8. You want something to eat, it's you know, and people say, well, you work in a press room, so you probably get whatever you want there. But that's not really what I'm saying. I think morally I can't quite square myself with what they charge, you know, because I have been a member at Cheltenham. I have paid to go racing. I'll probably pay, you know, I'll probably slip off the press accreditation list, you know, when I go and work for my new job and come back. And, you know, if I want to go racing, I'll have to pay to go racing, and that's fine. I accept that. But
it's a bit of a strange one, because I think as a punter, if you want the experience, you'll pay the money and you'll go to the Cheltenham Festival. If you enjoy the sport, for what it is as a grassroots thing, you'll go to the April meet and enjoy the 2 days then.
Yeah, yeah. Or you'll go Paddy Power, you know, what used to be Paddy Power. I don't know whether it's still the Paddy Power. It's changed so many times, hasn't it? The November meeting, yeah. It was the Mackeson back in my day. It'll always be the Mackeson. Or that early meeting in October, the Christmas meeting, or, you know, whether you want to go January the 1st or whatever. Yeah, you have the choice, don't you? You have the choice, yes or no. Whether you want to go, I prefer to watch the Friday afternoon. You know, last couple of years, established football club, big screens, a few mates, a couple of pints of Guinness, and you know that fills up quite nicely. You get a bit of atmosphere. You can still get your bets on, and you can have a bit of a laugh and a joke, and you can go to the loo when you want. You know, but that's me. That, you know, I'm 53 years of age. I'm getting to that stage in my life where I wouldn't necessarily want to go and stand around for 7 or 8 hours. I do also think that, you know, some of these big meetings, it is developing. I wouldn't say there's a rather foreboding presence about it, but there is. I wouldn't say there's this bonhomie that there was back in the 90s and 2000s. I think there is a drug problem on racecourses. I think there's a drink problem on racecourses. I think the atmosphere on certain courses. I mean, we've seen fights break out at certain tracks as well. Yeah, admittedly, not so many at Cheltenham, although I wouldn't blame some people sometimes trying to keep warm having a scuffle. But I do think that racing has a responsibility, and that they are trying very hard, you know, with sniffer dogs and one or two other, you know, things to try and obviously stop this taking over, but as recreational drugs have become ever more popular in society, that's obviously reflected in the patrons that go racing and go for a good drink up and whatever else they want to take. And I think that's a bit of an issue. I've seen it firsthand at Cheltenham, and it shocked me. You know, I've been in pubs and clubs all my life and never seen it so brazenly utilised, let's say, a substance as I did at Cheltenham, and it did quite shock me, you know. And I'm a, all right, I've led a very blinkered life. I'm a Codsall boy, but you know, we obviously didn't live too far out of Wolverhampton, which is a big wide world, and you know, having Birmingham on our doorsteps and stuff. But yeah, I was amazed to see it. I think that sort of thing, you know, really does need policing better than it is at the moment. If you're going to pay £130-140 for a top level experience, you don't want to be stood next to somebody in a urinal who's, you know, utilising that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that and talk about police and security in particular. I mean, the situations you talk about, I saw at Ascot when I first went there, and it was very much an eye-opener. And to a certain extent, there tend to be I find the southern courses that have this issue rather than the northern courses. I don't know, perhaps there's southern people got more money to spend. I don't know, but that's just my feeling. But staying with policing and security, obviously we've had issues at meetings, the Derby and also the Grand National, where there's been breaches of security by welfare groups and Just Stop Oil campaigners and whatever. Is enough being done to perhaps police these big events?
I think it's difficult, isn't it? I was there at the Derby when, you know, they were obviously aware they were going to get some protesters from an animal rights campaign. I think they did as much as they could. I was also at the test match, actually, first day at Lord's, and Just Stop Oil, it occurred right in front of me. Basically, they ran down the gangway to my right and launched themselves over. If it wasn't for Johnny Bairstow, they'd have got on the pitch. He came and handled one and carried one off on his own, off his own back, which wasn't a bad effort with a busted ankle.
First catch he'd taken all series, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Well, you might say that. I'm not going to comment. He's a racing fan, Johnny, so I've got to look after him. He also made good runs as well and took a couple of blinders, didn't he? So he probably exonerated himself there. Yeah, I think it's difficult to... You can never rule out this. If people are intent on doing it, what amazes me is that, you know, Just Stop Oil get tickets for all these premier sporting events. I can't get them. And I work in the game. They seem to get some very good seats as well. They were right down the front of the grandstand on the front row. Amazing how they managed to get those. So it was obviously a well-executed plan. And obviously they've got somebody backing them to decent numbers because they keep getting on all these events. But it's just like golf, you know. There was rumours that Formula One, they were going to try and do that at Silverstone. Obviously, the test match, they had to go out, the Derby, Grand National. I think, you know, the Grand National was obviously... I think if they could have their time again, they might have given those horses a little bit more of a breather at the start. It was all a bit frenetic. I'm not saying the animal rights team caused that issue, but they certainly didn't help. You know, and given that they're trying to campaign for, you know, horse welfare and better horse welfare, I don't think they help the situation there, really.
On a negative note, there's quite a lot of negative. Oh, there's lots of positives.
Well, I am a Wolves fan, so I'm used to it. Negativity.
By the time this goes out, we'll know how the Manchester United game will have gone on. But... I was going to keep that question... Well, we'll ask that question now. I was going to ask who you support, why, how, and favourite moments, perhaps.
Originally, the first shirt I ever had was a Southampton shirt, because my family originated from down sort of Southampton. My mum's from Portsmouth. My mum's mum lived in Southampton. So I had the old red and white 1976 FA Cup shirt in the acrylic, still got it at home. But then obviously going to school, mixing with loads of Wolves fans over there, I sort of rapidly became a Wolves fan. Went to my first game sort of 77-78, I think, like somewhere like those, sat in the now defunct Waterloo stand, a wooden stand, and got the love of Wolves from that point on. You know, obviously saw the League Cup win early on in 1980, which was which was fortuitous, but enjoyable all the same. And then various declines all the way through, back down to the bottom of the old fourth division as well, which I probably went to more games then than I ever did, really. I mean, everybody will say that. There was only about 4,000, 5,000 of us there, but if you listen to all the people that went to Chorley, there was probably 100,000 at Burnden Park when we drew 1 each, but I did actually go to that as well. So home and away, I used to go a fair bit in my teens, and I've always sort of followed the club from that point on, you know, through good and bad.
Can I survive this season? Can they survive in the Premier League this season?
Well, I was looking at the table today. I think there's 6 that can go down, of which we're one of them, I think. We've just got to hope there's 3 worse than us. I think Gary O'Neill might do a little bit better than people are giving him credit for. I spoke to Tommy Elphick, who was assistant to him last year at Bournemouth, or was on the coaching staff, and he says you'll always have a plan. You'll always be, you know, tactically very astute. Not all Bournemouth fans would share that view, but, you know, Tommy felt that there would always be a plan. Now, whether that was a bit negative or not, I don't know, but, you know, I'm used to that. We've had a couple of negative managers recently, so I think Wolves fans are well, you know, versed with that.
We'll finish off talking about your future plans in a moment or two, but I did want to touch on the negative side of horse racing, in particular affordability checks and also the lack of prize money at the moment in the sport, which means a lot of good horses are being sold abroad, and the UK is sort of becoming like a second-rate country, really, for horse racing. Do you feel that it is on a downward slide, the sport, at the moment, or can you see chinks of light at the end of the tunnel?
I can't see many chinks of light at the moment, unfortunately, Adam. I think it's very depressing. I think these overzealous affordability checks are really going to hurt racing in the long term, and I think you hear any number of people, you know, Sir Mark Prescott's been the latest one to come out and voice his concerns, and it has to be a massive issue. I mean, I probably bet less now than I've ever done in, you know, 30, 35 years. I mean, look, you can go into the where's and why's and wherefores. I've got a couple of accounts that still, you know, lay me bets, a reasonable bet, but most of the others don't. I wouldn't say I'm a massive winning punter. I would win. I would used to turn over quite a lot of money, and I would win a small, you know, percentage of that. But, you know, I wouldn't be a multi-millionaire from betting by any stretch of the imagination. And I know a number of lads, you know, very well, that are sort of recreational Saturday punters, might have a few bets in the festivals. They just can't get on. They just get restricted. You know, you hear stories of, you know, some people will back a horse at 10-1 on a new account. It'll go off 4-1. It'll get beat, but they'll still have their account shut because the algorithm of the bookmaker has said, oh, they've identified them as a warm punter who's beaten the price. And, sorry, we don't want your bets anymore. I mean, it's ludicrous, you know. And this is all hurting the sport because it means that turnover's down, which is a big issue because obviously that's how racing derives the levy, and the prize money stems from that. And until we come up with a different funding model, which I can't see ever happening, I think it's always going to be a massive issue. I can't see if they want to sustain the same amount of racing, so you've got the same size pie and the prize money goes into that pie, unless you reduce that pie down and reduce the amount of races run, how is prize money ever going to increase? Because people are betting less. People can't get on. People are having affordability checks that is just turning them away from the game because or it's turning them to the black market. Well, we're not getting any, you know, derivative from the black market. The black market money has just gone overseas or wherever it's gone, under the radar. So racing's not benefiting from that. So if we're not careful, we're looking into, you know, rather deep black hole.
Are there too many courses wanting too much of the pie? I say that in the respect that I think when the pandemic came, we thought that perhaps one or two courses might go by the wayside, and that never actually happened. But they're still trying to fight to survive at the moment with whatever they can. I've said for many years there's far too much racing and far too much low-quality racing. But nothing seems to have changed. Nobody seems to have sort of grasped this and done anything about it.
No, and I suppose because they're all, you know, very much businesses in their own right. You know, a great majority are owned by the Jockey Club. There are other, you know, ARC obviously own a good number of the others. And because they get so much money in media rights, you know, there are certain courses that would prefer to race without a crowd there. because they're still earning X amount of money from media rights. If they put on races with over eight runners and good each way terms, their media rights are such that, you know, they could get 100,000 plus from a meeting. And if they haven't got a staff fit and they haven't got, you know, what they get through the gate on a, you know, a Wednesday afternoon, a cold Wednesday afternoon in February, it doesn't justify all the staffing. They'd rather have all the bars shut and just run the races, you know, like we would in COVID time. You know, and you can understand that. It's not for the good of the sport, but you can understand that because it, financially and business-wise, it makes such a, you know, makes some perfect sense. And this is what worries me a little bit, is that I think there has to be a bit more give and take from people. Now, we have seen a fair bit of manipulation recently and the body of racing coming together a little bit and working out various things, and the premierisation of fixtures is something going forward that they're trying. They're trying to have that window on a Saturday afternoon where it's only the peak quality that is shown on terrestrial television. But that's often the case anyway. You know, ITV would only show the leading races from York or Sandown or Cheltenham or wherever it might be. So that's sort of happening already. The thing that used to get stuck in my claw was having covered Royal Ascot for RTV, you know, 10 minutes before Royal Ascot starts, there's a 3-mile chase around Perth or Kelso. And you were literally, I mean, I remember one year doing it with Angus McNay, the Queen Anne, and we literally had 90 seconds to talk about the Queen Anne. Now, I know we'd done a morning programme and we'd done a preview perhaps at the top of the show, but how can you have one of the premier, you know, Group 1 mile races at the Royal Meeting and you've got 90 seconds to talk about it because, you know, Perth have jumped away slowly and there's been a 3-mile chase with slow horses running around. I mean, it's nonsensical, isn't it? You just couldn't do it. You know, it's like having a cup final, having a big Premier League game which finishes 2 minutes before the cup final and they haven't got time to preview it. It's mad. But that's racing, that's what they do, you know. And we saw it at Galway and Goodwood last week when, you know, they jumped. There's two races that were off together and Galway wouldn't hold and we had a split screen. And you just think, well, what are you trying to achieve here, lads? You know, couldn't you just hold on for 1 minute for the flat race to finish? It's not like you're waiting for a 10-minute jump race to finish. You're waiting for a 1-minute flat race to finish, and they just couldn't do it. So there's not a lot of cooperation sometimes. It's a bit frustrating.
Lack of common sense as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, you know. Look, I wouldn't profess to have any answers at all, but I speak to a lot of people who talk a lot of common sense, and I think the commentators are vastly underused on this because people like Stuart Mage and Steve Powell, who's also local to us from Birmingham, he's on the commentary roster now, Ian Bartlett, Richard Hoyles, these are people with really good minds, very clever people, and they see fixture clashes all over the place. They see, you know, well, no, say there's 3 2-mile chases on successive, you know, weeks, and the last one has 4 runners for about 20 grand because there's no horses left to run in it, you know. And Stuart will say to me, well, why have they moved that from there to there when if they'd have left it where it was, they'd have got 10 runners or 12 runners there, but they moved it for some reason and they get 4 runners, you know, and that then affects the levy. It also affects the media rights that the race course gain. It's just sometimes it's just nonsensical, some of the decisions that are made. And, you know, thankfully the people like Lydia Hislop, Nick Luck, Rishi Prasad, these guys are on committees now where they can make a bit of a difference and they talk a lot of sense. And I think that's crucial going forward. We're going to need all the help we can get, I think.
You realise if you're a board marker now, you'd be the fittest person in the world.
Yeah, I would, yeah. I was pretty fit then, evading things that were thrown at me, to be honest. It certainly helped with the ducking and weaving on a Sunday afternoon with a quick bowler from Old Brighton or wherever it were, Thompson's, or wherever we were playing on a Sunday afternoon. You had to be on your toes doing the board, that was for sure.
But, in a word, will racing in this country survive?
In what? In how long?
In the next 10 years.
I worry for jump racing, if I'm honest. I do worry for jump racing. I think, you know, without the patronage of a few big owners and one or two, you know, I think once competition, and we've seen at Cheltenham recently with Willie Mullins dominating so much and the Irish dominating so much, and British owners are now bleeding over to, you know, they are, you know, disappearing over to Ireland. Good British owners who have always had horses with You know, Henderson, Nichols, you know, these are top trainers. Nichols has won the championship 14 times. Nicky Henderson, you know, these are people who know what they're doing, and they can't produce horses that are competitive enough in novice hurdles at Cheltenham. I know Nicky won with Constitution Hill and stuff, but I don't think he had a runner in any of the novice hurdles this year, if memory serves. Somebody will put me right. But, you know, Paul Nichols, oh, no, we're not going there for as a social runner. No, he had a bit of success this year at Cheltenham, thankfully. But... You do wonder that, you know, these guys have got to think they've got a chance of winning, and they're not just firing bullets at a, you know, a tiny target, because Mullins has got 2, 3, 4. You know, one of his main ones will be a non-runner, and he'll have a raft of others just to step right up. The battalions will just step right up. You know, he's got 250 horses, and he's unveiling horses that are getting cut for the Supreme Novices Hurdle at Galway in August. It's mad, really, and they probably wouldn't be anywhere near the pecking, near the top of the pecking order.
So are you saying that National Hunt racing will survive in Ireland but not in the UK?
Well, it'll have to survive in the UK, because it won't survive in Ireland if it doesn't, because otherwise Willie Mullins and Gordon Elliott will win every race going. Henry de Bromhead will win the odd race here and there, and Joseph O'Brien might chip in, and people will just get turned off, because you need competition in sport, don't you? You know, the last thing you want is somebody dominating the sport. And look, we've always had it. I mean, you know, Martin Pipe won the championship for year after year and dominated Cheltenham. You know, Paul Nichols has had his spell doing it. Nicky has had his spell doing it. And now it's Willie Mullins' turn. But I really can't see at the moment, because he gets all the cream of the crop from Ireland, all the breeders from Ireland, and also from France. You know, and you can't get near these horses. You have to have a lot of luck to be able to get near them. And you need the ammunition. Fergal O'Brien has over 100 winners a year, wins £1 million in prize money, and hasn't really sniffed a Cheltenham winner yet. You know, he's a really good trainer. 20% strike rate over jumps is phenomenal. He has an incredible amount of success. And yet, how many Cheltenham horses is he producing? You know, if he nicks one, it might be a you know, handicapped chase over 3 miles, and he might just nick one with a 16-1 chance or something like that. But very, very difficult to go to Cheltenham with a favourite in one of those, you know, leading pattern races, a grade one, and think you've got a real good chance of beating Willie Mullins.
So are you sort of saying that we're now getting to a point in the UK where people won't go for the racing because the quality of the racing won't be as good as, say, what it is in Ireland, and you won't see the best horses, and people will perhaps go for the extras that are put on by the courses, like concerts and whatever?
I still think National Hunt people will go racing. I think there's a hardcore of National Hunt racing fans that will go, you know, whatever. They go pointing, they go, you know, National Hunt racing, they go to Ludlow, and it's, you know, 1 degree in December.
Or are we just happy to accept poor quality racing?
I think we're probably... There has been, obviously, a talent drain, certainly on the flat, you know, down to Australia, down to, you know, to the Emirates, to wherever, you know, Bahrain, America, wherever it might be. And, you know, that's one of my jobs, really. I do some work with the bloodstock agents, and, you know, you identify a good one, and they say, well, let me know, you know, if it's a mile or 10 furlong horse, we could go to Cox Plate, you know, we've got a million budget. You know, these people are spending big money, and sometimes you just can't get near these horses because they've already had three agents on already. They've only won a maiden at Thirsk and a novice race at York, but they're already like £1 million. People want £1 million for them, you know, and it's, people are still willing to pay that for the dream of it, because the prize money is so good in Australia, we can't match it because of our funding model. And theirs is different, obviously, because it's a, you know, they use the toes as well as bookmakers, so they get a lot of, like France, you know, that's why prize money in France is so good. There's no bookmakers, so the big percentage of the pari mutuel just goes straight into racing, straight into the pot of prize money, and that's why it's so good. You get, you know, breeders' premiums. If your horse was bred in France, you get an extra bonus on top. If you win a race out there, you know, it might be €10,000. It's like incredible money. You can actually make it pay, whereas here you have to win 4 or 5 races a year, perhaps, to break even. Sometimes, if you've got a horse of a certain ability, you're not going to do that, are you?
Difficult times.
Yeah, I think it is difficult. And, you know, like you say, with the affordability checks, the welfare issue, there are some massive, massive battles ahead for racing, unfortunately. And it needs strong leadership, and I don't know really whether there are we are capable of navigating through those choppy waters. I thought COVID would have been a great chance for us to reset. There was no racing. People had a chance to clear their desks, clear their mind for 6 weeks. And unfortunately, although certain things were changed, primarily the only things were that jockeys couldn't have a sauna and jockeys could only ride at one meeting. There was no... They didn't affect the fixture list at all. You know, they've chopped it and they've tinkered around with it. But really, it's just like, you know...
It's the same, just at different times of the day.
Well, it is, isn't it? It's a lick of paint here, a lick of paint there. But it's they haven't really... They haven't, you know... What is it, 10,000 races a year or something? They could have gone, right, we're going to get rid of 500 of those. What amazes me is that owners are still willing to pay money to have horses in training. This cost of living crisis, it seems... That doesn't seem to be dipping at all, and the horse population is, all right, decreasing, but there still seems to be people that are willing to put their hand up and pay $400,000 or $500,000 for a nice prospect from France or, you know, a well-bred Frank. Or the money's still incredible, still floating around the sales ring, which I found absolutely extraordinary.
And I suppose you'll always get people who've got a love of the sport anyway, so they'll get involved with syndicates, which is becoming more and more popular.
Yeah, and that's one positive, isn't it? Micro-ownership's very good. You know, you can own a small share in something for 90 quid or 60 quid. There's a load of good syndicates that are around at the moment that you can get involved with, and you can have, you know, a fair bit of enjoyment with those. And you can get... I mean, I'm fortunate enough to know Paul Nichols fairly well. He's got a number of big syndicates with him, Race Owners Group and Old Gold and all these different people. And they have, you know, he very kindly opens up the stables, you know, twice a year for a stable visit. You know, it's a big part of the game, that is, you know, and I think the communication from that yard's very good. They have people that manage the syndicates well, and they, you know, you get videos and you get newsletters and you get all this sort of stuff, you know. You might not get told, yeah, look, your horse is going to win today. You know, they might be optimistic about it. But I do think that sort of way is the way forward for owners to enjoy a little bit. I think that's much better value, for instance, than perhaps even going racing sometimes, because you can have an involvement in three or four horses. I know people who do this for £75, £100, you know, total of £300 or £400. And they'll get badges, they'll go into a ballot and they'll get badges for those anyway, you know, and you'll be able to go racing a fair bit. I should just say as well that, I mean, look, I'm not a big fan of the Racing League, but they've offered a lot of free tickets to try and get that going as well. So the deals are out there if you hunt around a little bit. And, you know, if you get a membership for your local course, you often get that at a vastly reduced rate. So there is value to be had racing. And nobody's putting a gun to your head and saying you've got to go and have 5 pints of Guinness at £7.50 a pop either. So, you know, you can make your choices and you can still enjoy the sport at a relatively fair rate. I mean, I don't know how much Ludlow was last year, but, you know, perhaps 20 quid to get into club for 7 or 8 races. It's not bad value, really, is it? You know, I don't know how much Stourbridge charge for...
Martin would tell Andy Bountney.
Well, they're winning a couple of games at the moment, so it's well worth it. So it's good to see, but...
I can definitely advocate the syndicate route. I've got a leg in a horse. And although I don't own the horse outright, it feels as though I do, because it's just nice to see the horse run. Albeit, I have to say, I haven't... because it's trained by Rebecca Menzies up in Sedgefield. I haven't actually seen it run live yet, but... It's just nice to feel part of it sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've been in a number of syndicates. It's very rare. I mean, I've owned a few horses, and it's very rare. Well, I can't remember. I'm in a syndicate now, Harry Derham. There's 10 of us, and I don't think I've ever owned a horse outright on my own. I just couldn't afford it. And, you know, Daily Mail wage, no chance. Too busy paying Boris Johnson £1 million a year.
Black Country Radio money, you've definitely got no chance.
I'm looking for that big brown envelope full of nothing. So I would advocate it as well, because you get emotionally attached. It doesn't matter how much of them you own, whether it's 2.5%, whether it's, you know, literally a millionth or whatever it is, because you're following that horse closely. And, you know, if you're lucky, you're going to get a stable visit as well. I just think that you're just going to be emotionally attached to that horse, whether you own 100% of it or 1% of it.
Why are you letting the gig of Robin Goodfellow go?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I had a bit of a life-changing experience in December 2020 when I lost my wife. And I think I'd been at it for, was it 14 years then? And put my heart and soul into the job and really, really grafted with a lot of intensity. I was lucky to have some success. I had some rubbish times as well, you know, days where you go 30 days without having a winning nap and everything would happen that you could imagine could happen to horses to get beat. You know, we've all been there, haven't we? And I think I'd probably done whatever I could do in the job, really. It took a lot of time, and I think there was probably a small percentage of me that resented that I was grafting that hard and what I'd probably missed, you know, doing things as a couple. We could have done a bit more. And it was like full on, it's got to be racing, I've got to work till half past nine every night and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, normal couples would get out for meals and do this and do that. We didn't do so much of that. When we had a break and we had a holiday, there were good holidays and we loved it, but I think there was a bit of me that felt guilty that, right, I'm not going to put any relationship or second to a job. And that was really, I think every tipster as well has a bit of a shelf life. And I think there's only so many times that you can write the same article about a race. So it was just a case of thinking, well, do you know what? I think I'm done here now. I don't see myself improving my fortunes. I think I've had a good run. I've won a few titles here and there. I've done all right. I've kept my head above water with it. But is my love for watching the Brighton Mile handicap on a Tuesday afternoon still the same as it was 10 years ago? Is it time to give somebody my age, when I took over, a run at it and give them an opportunity and think, you know, yeah, I think it is. I think, you know, can I still see myself doing this next year, sitting in the same office for hour after hour after hour doing this? And I just felt, I think the time was right. You know, I think sometimes you just got to take a bit of a chance in life and, you know, I think, well, what's the worst can happen? I can come back from where I'm going to 6 months later when they've seen through me and, you know, try and get a job in the real world. But I think it was time, yeah.
Can we ask what you're going to do next?
Yeah, sure. I'm relocating to Dubai, so it's a bit of a career adjustment. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Going in September to edit their magazine, the Dubai Racing Club magazine, called Adiat Racing Plus. Work on their website and work on their magazine. They do a weekly magazine through the Dubai season from November through to Dubai World Cup end of March. Colour mag, like 100-page colour mag, 50 pages in English, 50 pages Arabic. Really nice quality magazine. So got some staff there, got some writers, one of which is Marcus Townend of the Daily Mail.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, he was there before I am, but now I'm his boss, which I'm looking forward to. Yeah, I'll be sending his stuff back to him saying, please rewrite. it'll be a bit of a challenge. I'm under no illusion that it'll be me outside my comfort zone. I think there'll be a fair bit of digital stuff to do as well. That's the way of all magazines and newspapers now. You've got to produce, you know, podcasts and videos and all this sort of stuff. And social media needs a good look at. And they haven't got a YouTube channel yet, which hopefully I can try and build. But, yeah, it's exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
Does that mean you're moving out of the area for good?
Not for good, no. I'm keeping my house. We've got some good house sitters, family, friends. They're going to look after the place and hopefully stop it from you know, getting damp through the winter, and I hope to be back in the late spring for the summer season here, basically. But no, I'm staying in the area. I still have my roots in Stourbridge, most definitely.
And what will you do during the summer months when you're back?
Well, I think I will have some time off, but I'll also be working, but just in this country for Adiat Racing. So basically I'm editing the magazine. So I'm the English editor. They've also got an Arabic editor as well. Hopefully I'll be getting to cover some of the bigger meetings as well for them live and on the ground, which would be great, you know. So I won't have to come up with tips and produce losers. At least I'll just be reporting on the races. And
Lots of trips to Maidan, which would be a bit of an experience.
Yeah, so I'm looking to live up round there as well. That's where we're looking to relocate to. So Friday nights in Maidan. I'm told there's 9 race cards as well, which might be a bit of a grind. I'm worried about like an 8 race card at Ludlow when they stick a bumper on the end at 5 o'clock. But yeah, there could be a 9 race card at Maidan every Friday night to look forward to. And then we've got Jebel Ali on a Saturday. And then there's Arab racing at 2 or 3 other venues as well. So there's plenty to get your teeth into.
Well, I hope you enjoy your future over in Dubai. It's been a fascinating chat over the last 90 minutes. Really appreciate your time. And we look forward to catching up with you in due course. Sam Turner, thank you.
Cheers, Adam. Thanks very much.
Black Country Radio Sports.